Fortunately, most areas were not hit catastrophically, but there were damages across 1,000 miles of coastline.
The state wraps up its damage assessment from the Bering Sea storm. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Cook Inlet beluga will stay on the endangered species list.
There's a recovery team right now working on a plan to help recover belugas, and that work will go forward.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Alaska senators expressed disappointment this afternoon at word that the Special Congressional Supercommittee has given up its attempt to combat the federal debt. The Joint Deficit Reduction Committee was made up of 6 Republicans and 6 Democrats, half from the House and half from the Senate. They officially threw in the towel today after a week where a deal looked less and less promising by the day. Alaska senators were encouraging the group to go big and offer up a substantive plan that would make major cuts to the deficit. Senator Mark Begich reacted today to news that won't happen.
Disappointed frustration, I think, and I think most Alaskans that I talk to are frustrated mostly about the inability for elected officials to, you know, step up to the plate, compromise, work together, and get things done.
As a Democrat, Begich points to his work with the other two members of the Alaska delegation, both Republicans, as an example of how lawmakers can unite when they need to over common issues. Senator Lisa Murkowski's office put out a statement today saying the debate isn't over and that more work, in fact harder work, must now be done to draw down the debt. She's calling for a combination of spending cuts, reform to entitlement programs, changes in the federal budgeting process, and a tax code overhaul. Murkowski says the stakes are growing more by the day. Congressman Don Young was a critic of the supercommittee from its start 3 months ago and said he wanted to see all of Congress involved. A special investigator who probed into misconduct by prosecutors in the case of the late Alaska Senator Ted Stevens says the government lawyers should not face criminal charges. Despite that, the investigator found widespread concealment of evidence that could have helped Stevens mount his defense. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
Ted Stevens was the longest-serving Republican in the Senate when he was convicted 3 years ago of failing to list on his financial disclosure forms gifts he'd received. Prosecutors said they amounted to $250,000 and included items like house renovations and a massage chair. But accusations of misconduct by FBI agents and withholding of evidence by prosecutors soon surfaced. And when the Obama administration came into power, Attorney General Eric Holder asked that the verdict be vacated. The judge who oversaw the case, U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan, threw it out and ordered an independent investigator, D.C. Attorney Henry Schulke, to look into what happened. After 2.5 years of silence on the case, Judge Sullivan filed an order Monday saying that the investigation had results. It found that the Stevens prosecution was permeated by systematic concealment of significant evidence, which Stevens' lawyers could have used to corroborate the senator's story and testimony. It also could have seriously damaged the testimony and credibility of the government's key witness, former VCO executive Bill Allen. Schulke found that at least some of the concealment by the government was willful and intentional. Despite that, he's not claiming that the prosecutors committed criminal violations. Schulke says that's because Judge Sullivan did not issue a clear and unequivocal order directing the prosecutors to follow the law. When, during the trial, prosecutors admitted holding back evidence, Judge Sullivan admonished them and said, "We all know what the law is," and that they, in good faith, knew they had to provide relevant information to the defense. But Schulke says that wasn't a clear direction. Judge Sullivan, for his part, says the prosecutorial misconduct was to a degree he hadn't seen in 25 years on the bench. The independent investigator Henry Schulke and a colleague, William Shields, came to their conclusions after reviewing more than 150,000 pages of documents and interviewing witnesses, holding depositions, and familiarizing themselves with two Alaska cases against former state legislators Pete Cott and Vic Coring. The massive report by Schulke and Shields is 500 pages and shielded from the public eye until the Justice Department and the six attorneys under question can review it and decide if they want to challenge making it public. And DOJ and the lawyers may indeed fight that. This isn't the only investigation into the Stevens case. The Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility is conducting its own look into what went wrong and who's responsible. Earlier this month, Attorney General Holder told a Senate panel that that multi-hundred-page report will be coming out soon, but it's unclear whether it will see the light of day and be made public. Ted Stevens lost his bid for re-election 1 week after being convicted in 2008. He died in a plane crash near Dillingham last year. Last week would have marked his 88th birthday. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
State and federal disaster survey crews have departed western Alaska after visiting communities impacted by the fall storm. The team based in Nome left yesterday after surveying Nome, Teller, Brevik Mission, and Unalakleet. A total of 16 communities were surveyed along the west coast of the state. John Madden is the director of the State Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He says one challenge in understanding the scope of damage is the enormous area ranging from Togiak in the south to Point Hope in the north.
First disaster in some years in which it's been this widespread. Fortunately, most areas were not hit catastrophically, but there were damages across 1,000 miles of coastline in those 35 to 40 communities. So it's going to be a while before we can get a good, solid estimate of all the damage, and then that will be the basis for what options we have to address that.
The teams are now crunching numbers and compiling information to pass on to the governor and his disaster policy cabinet. The governor will make the decision on whether to declare a disaster and activate the state's disaster relief programs. Governor Parnell could request a federal declaration if the damage is beyond the capability of the state's disaster program. Madden intends to have the report to the governor sometime next week, with a decision following soon after. He says the time and labor-intensive portion of the process is happening right now.
It takes a lot of time on the ground, and after we get those individual interviews with owners and people who live there, then we put them all together into a larger statewide package. That's the time-consuming part. Once it gets in to the governor and his advisors, it doesn't take much at all after that.
The state has received local disaster declarations from Good News Bay, Kivalina, Nome, and the Northwest Arctic Borough. Madden says there are likely more communities that wish to issue declarations but do not have the staff resources to do so. Madden says the relatively small amount of damage is due to early warning, good local preparations, and some luck.
As most of us in Alaska know, and people on the coast know it better than all, that it just takes a few points difference on the direction of the wind can make a big difference on how much water and where that water goes. You still need to be very mindful that the next storm is always just over the horizon.
The department's Jeremy Zedek says the team in Nome had hoped to get to Little Diomede, but Evergreen Helicopters was not flying. A 28-year-old All-American cross-country runner who suffered frostbite after spending more than 2 days in frigid Alaska temperatures without winter gear has had his feet amputated just above the ankles. Mark Chisetto disappeared from the University of Alaska Anchorage on November 6th and was found November 9th, suffering from hypothermia and severe frostbite to his feet and hands. The UAA Athletic Department says in a website posting that Chisetto's hands are expected to make a full recovery, but his lower extremities were so severely injured they required amputation. Chisetto was one of several runners from Kenya who competed for UAA. In a statement released by the university, Chisetto acknowledged he was experiencing personal problems when he walked away from campus, and he thanked people who searched for him. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the changing economies for the halibut fleet in Alaska.
The prices for halibut are in the nosebleed area, and yet the product is still in such demand.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A federal court in Washington, D.C. has upheld the endangered species listing of Cook Inlet beluga whales. The Parnell administration had sued to overturn the 2008 listing by the National Marine Fisheries Service, arguing that the whales were recovering and did not need the extra protection that came with the listing. It also claimed endangered protection would be an economic blow to the tourism, oil, and fishing industries. The Center for Biological Diversity was one of six groups that intervened in the case. Alaska Director Rebecca Noblin said, as the decision leaves in place all the protections that went along with the listing.
It still has its critical habitat in the Cook Inlet. There's a recovery team right now working on a plan to help recover belugas, and that work will go forward. And all of the prohibitions to protect the whale will stay in place. So the federal government can't allow any activities that would jeopardize the beluga or destroy its habitat in Cook Inlet.
The state can appeal the decision. Attorney General John Burns said the state is weighing its options, but he believes the process used by the federal government to determine the listing was defective because it didn't involve the state or consider conservation measures that were already in place at the time of the listing. The CEO of the Alaska Natural Gas Development Authority has turned in his resignation so he can, quote, pursue other opportunities. Harold Hines has been in the top job at the authority since voters set it up in the 2002 election.
The timing is right for me, but it's the right time for Angda to look at some new leadership. I enjoyed being able to work on the gas pipeline and all the gas issues, but again, the situation in the state is such that it needs to all get sorted out one more time.
The ballot initiative that established ANGDA led Hines and the authority to become involved in several of the projects that could deliver natural gas to markets outside the state while supplying energy to Alaskans also. Hines says most recently the emphasis has been on developing markets and facilities that would deliver propane to those parts of the state away from the rail belt. He says he's confident that the authority's current projects will continue.
There's a small but very competent and experienced staff here. More importantly, we have several very high-quality contractors that are more than capable of carrying forward the work that needs to be done. Our resources are limited, so it's up to the board of directors to kind of decide what priorities they want to set and how they want to work through a process of considering our future.
Although more than 62% of the voters approved the initiative setting up the authority 9 years ago, the idea has not yet been well received by the executive branch. Governor Murkowski delayed funding and appointing people to work for the agency. Sarah Palin did not immediately provide operating money for its work, and Sean Parnell has left four vacancies on the ANGDA Board of Directors. That leaves less than a quorum to accept Hines' resignation and appoint his successor. Contractors working in the basement of APRN member station KCAW in Sitka discovered human remains in late October. The remains likely predate the 103-year-old building that houses the station, KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
The remains were found in between two slabs of bedrock and are believed to be very old. KCAW General Manager Ken Fate says when the discovery was made, work was stopped immediately.
And the first thing we had to do was figure out what to do.
The police were contacted and, with the help of an archaeologist, determined that the remains were old and that the area was not a crime scene. Forest Service archaeologist Jay Kinsman then looked over the site for other materials, namely wood or fiber.
Those things would be clues as to when the bones were there. And possibly where the bones had come from, but there was none of that.
Fate says Kinsman was unable to determine the age, sex, or ethnicity of the remains.
Erring on the side of caution, we determined that we'd better treat them as if they might be culturally significant, and we determined that we wanted to contact the Sitka Tribe of Alaska. And that's what we went ahead and did.
The tribe's cultural committee met, and elders were contacted. Sitka Tribe Resource Protection Director Jeff Feldpouch said the elders decided to offer a blessing over the remains.
Initially, they felt the ceremony should be done regardless whether the remains were native or not, and basically, pay respects and apologize for the disturbance.
Fate from KCAW says the next step is to learn more.
The area appears to be, according to the archaeologist on site, fill that was put in place in the Russian era. And so whether or not the skeleton was there before the building was put up or after is unknown. And talking to elders that came over from the Sitka Tribe of Alaska, they indicated that this area was not a village site and was not a cemetery. And so there is an element of mystery about where these bones came from and when. And to the best of our ability, we're hoping to respectfully find out as much as we can and do the right thing by these bones.
Feldpouch told the tribal council during its regular meeting on Wednesday that learning more could involve DNA testing. If the bones are not native, then the tribe's involvement would likely conclude. If they are native bones, Feldpouch says there could be a reinterment of the remains in a more suitable location and other protocols.
I'm not totally familiar with them, but I know there have been some reburials in the past, so we're going to rely on those elders to pass that knowledge on.
Meanwhile, work continues underneath the cable house. The area of the basement containing the skeleton remains cordoned off and will be undisturbed. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
The final day of the 2011 commercial halibut fishery was on Friday, and the season ended with Kodiak overtaking Homer as the top port for halibut landings in the state. It's the first time that's happened since the individual fishery quota, or IFQ, management system was put in place in the mid-1990s. As KBBI's Marsha Lynn reports, several factors have influenced the turnaround.
Someone who's tracked Alaska's commercial fishery since 1988 first broke the story on her statewide program, Fish Radio.
It jumped out at me the week before the fishery closed. I was checking the stats, and I went, holy cow, Kodiak has gotten a couple hundred more landings than Homer and is beating them in poundage for the first time in memory.
Over the years, Kodiak-based fisheries journalist Lainey Welch has religiously checked the National Marine Fisheries Service website for daily updates on halibut landings. She says since the IFQ system was implemented in 1995, Homer's been on top.
Since that time, perhaps in 1996, Homer has always led for halibut landings. Because I can remember there was a lot of grumbling going on in Kodiak about so many boats going to Homer from Kodiak because Homer always was able to pay a higher price because they're on the road system.
Longtime Homer-based halibut fisherman Christy Fry was also taken aback by the recent turn of events.
Toppled. We were toppled.
She says quota shifts between waters in the Central Gulf and around the south end of Kodiak Island could be one reason. Which brings up the question of how halibut dock prices have changed over the years. Kevin Hogan is president of the Auction Block, a Homer business he started in 1997.
I think when we started, we were around $1.20 a pound, and it hung around there for a number of years, got down to 90 cents a pound, and now it's pushing $7.
Homer's high dock prices have traditionally lured in halibut fishermen, but this year the price differential between Kodiak and Homer began to shrink. Higher fuel costs can also be factored in, says Fry, plus a trend of nastier weather.
Yeah, it does seem like our storms have gotten more intense and maybe a little more frequent. And people with smaller boats probably just don't want to chance it. You know, it just might not be worth the risk of running through Kennedy Entrance and through the Barrens and big seas.
While Hogan cites advances in technology.
With the sat phones and everything, the boats have the ability to stay in touch with the market a lot better than they used to. They used to just roll into port and start making phone calls. Now they make calls from the fishing grounds, and they know who's paying the most and where to get it.
He says while it's more expensive to fly out fresh product from an off-road port like Kodiak, current high prices have forced a market shift to increased frozen product, making shipping more cost-effective.
It's actually cheaper to ship frozen fish out of Kodiak than it is to Homer because of the cargo lines that go in there.
But one thing remains certain, according to fisheries journalist Lainey Welch, lots of people have a taste for the big flatfish.
The buyers I talk with all over the state are scratching their heads because the prices for halibut are in the nosebleed area, and yet the product is still in such demand. You know, the catch limits are down. There's less fish available across the board, and yet the buyers are demanding this fish.
She says sometimes pennies a pound can make a difference as to where fishermen deliver their catches, adding that high demand is centered primarily in U.S. markets. In Homer, I'm Marcia Lynn.
Over the weekend, national fishermen honored two Alaskans at the Pacific Marine Expo in Seattle. Bill Weber Jr. of Cordova and Dan Falvey of Sitka joined San Francisco's Larry Collins as the magazine's 2011 Highliners of the Year. The honor is not necessarily about the amount of fish anyone lands. Instead, the magazine's editors described the trio as bona fide innovators and men of action, each in his own way. Falvey is the fourth Sitka fisherman to be named to this elite roster, and he seemed a little surprised by the recognition. KCAW's Robert Woolsey enlisted the aid of a 2007 Highliner, Eric Jordan, to explain what it means to have your picture on the cover of a National Fisherman.
I'm a longline fisherman and a troller, and I think there's a lot of people out there who catch more fish than I do. So I'm not quite sure why I was chosen.
That's Dan Falvey. Just about everybody gets it but him. Here's Eric Jordan.
It's not about how many fish you catch or whether you were the top dog competitively. It's about what you did to contribute to the future of the fisheries.
I got into fishing because I was up in Alaska on a summer adventure and ran out of money in Sitka, and hopping on a fishing boat seemed like the best thing to do. And then after a while on the boat, I got good enough at my duties on deck that I could actually look around and see what an amazing place Alaska is and what a unique perspective you have as a fisherman. Being out there day in and day out, you're no longer an outsider looking in. You become kind of part of the natural processes.
Falvey's Alaska adventure ran short of cash in the 1980s. Not too long after, he went back to school to earn a master's degree from Western Washington University in resource management and policy. Issues that may frustrate anyone else are right in Falvey's sweet spot.
I was always really impressed with how clear Dan's thinking was on complex fisheries management, sharing, and conservation issues. He had a gift for analyzing and articulating the most complex issues in a way that helped clarify it for all those involved working with him.
Falvey began salmon trolling on the Seaboy, which he bought from Sitka's first national fisherman highliner, John Marr. Now he runs the 47-foot freezer boat Myriad.
I think after trolling for a lot of years, he just realized that by moving into the freezer, I was able to create a better product and actually able to stay out and follow the fish up and down the coast. Instead of having to come into town all the time. And so it gives you a certain freedom to just kind of stay out there and watch the run build and the run ebb and move where you need to go while you're creating one of the highest quality products that are able to be created.
Falvey is too young to have participated in the upheavals that shaped the modern salmon industry, but he'd have his opportunity in groundfish. Falvey and 2009 Highliner Linda Benkin have been the brain trust behind the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, ALFA, for most of its existence. Benkin would serve three terms on the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council during some of its stormiest years. Falvey served on the council's advisory panel. When the spray had settled, Eric Jordan says the book had been rewritten on halibut and black cod fishing in Southeast, and not just the book on individual fishing quotas, or IFQs.
The collaboration of him and Linda Benkin has been one of the great teams for our industry. When he was on the advisory panel and Linda was on the council, they worked together to really change the fisheries in Southeast. Everybody knows about the IFQ deal, but they also, one of the biggest things I think in the, that he worked on with Linda is taking the groundfish trawl fisheries out of Southeast Alaska into federal waters. That has changed the whole ecosystem here in Southeast Alaska for the better.
Recently, Alpha has branched out into research. Falvey is helping administer several concurrent grants studying issues ranging from sperm whale depredation to an onboard electronic observer program that could save the small boat fleet and the taxpayer money. Falvey hints that this work is a relief from the bluster of fisheries policy.
What I have most enjoyed is working with the innovation and natural problem-solving abilities that the fishing fleet has to apply those skills to address some of the issues we face. And I also like working with the scientists and the managers of our industry to try and integrate the perspective that the fishermen gain by being out there day in and day out with the perspective the fishery managers have. And I think when you bring those two perspectives together and you each can learn from each other, it helps result in a long-term sustainable future.
Sometimes the mantle just falls on you, and you don't choose it so much as you choose not to avoid it. It comes to you, and it's almost like a responsibility. And somebody with the gifts that Dan has, I think it wasn't so much a choice as it was a calling.
Dan Falvey has a wife, Kathy, and two kids, Emma, age 12, and Jake, 9. He says they're becoming more and more of a fishing family all the time. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Ed Ronco and Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Marsha Lynn in Homer. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of adding stability and security to our economy by settling Alaska families into homes across the state. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.